of you guys, you know, come here early in the morning. I feel like in this age of my life, you know, the number of the room actually matters less. It's a meaningful connection with all of you. So hopefully in the next 20 to 30 minutes, you can find something useful and meaningful. So today, let's do a very quick show of hands. How many of you in this room truly believe decentralized healthcare should be our future? Okay, let me ask you the next question. How many of you think it will be a global reality within our lifetime or your lifetime? So I think it's good. First of all, you came to the right conference. I think we're optimistic. And second, I think we are cautiously optimistic. Why is that? Well, here's some perspective. For mobile phone, it took us 30 years from the first commercial model to actual mass adoption. And we know healthcare, it always lagging behind, probably 7 to 10 years behind technology. And even compared to the retail, we're like a couple years, 3 to 5 years behind. Why? Highly regulated, risk-averse, complex, combined technology, society, ethical, everything's together. We're very complicated, and that's why I picked today's topic. Decentralized healthcare needs to bridge in all these components together. And I want to cover these three topics today. What have we learned? Why we have to think about technology and society together? Not just the one and the other. And three, really, unlock some of the hidden values through the potential collaboration and partnership. And I want to do that, give some more insights from my own journey. I stand here as a leader for a nonprofit organization. But my journey actually started in the lab. I was trained as a molecular and cell biologist and did my postdoc training research in gene therapy. And my first industry job is a computational biologist. And then the next 20 years, I worked on quantifying patients' outcomes, whether it's clinical trial or real-world data, dealing with regulators and payers over the world, trying to understand what they need to justify the price and value of our innovative therapies. In my last job at Takeda, I am responsible, my team, I'm a VP of Global Market Access, Value and Access for Takeda Oncology, and sit at Takeda's Digital Advisory Board. And through my years of on the private side, I realized some issues here. Capital alone may not work for health. So look at our food and beverage industry. We have generated some multi-billion giant like Coca-Cola. But does that really advance public health? This longevity influencer, Brian Johnson, put Coca-Cola on top of the leaderboard list for genocide leaderboard. I know it's extreme, but it says something important. Capital alone not necessarily equate to improved quality of life and our public health. And second, trust. Trust is always an issue when you're on the private side. I know no matter how advanced our data is, our technology is, when we're on the pharma side, there is always a trust issue. And for that reason, I decided to co-found a nonprofit organization, Ethros Health Data Foundation. And we aim to combine the best part of both the private and public sectors. And our mission is simple. We want to empower individuals to own and share and benefit from their own data. And collectively, hopefully, we can drive this paradigm shift towards the future of healthcare. And one of our first projects is this compendium. we want to take a look at all the successful, you know, ongoing organizations that truly in the decentralized healthcare, really trying to connect it to the consumers and see how the industry look like. So we published this 70-page report, give an overview, interviewed a lot of the companies, and you can certainly download this. It's a very comprehensive overview. Besides the common pain point and opportunities we identify from the report, I want to give some three additional, my personal takeaways, you know, through this study. Number one, B2C is still a challenge. Direct to consumer is a challenge. So a lot of the companies we talked to started with the intent direct to consumer, but ended up selling data to big entities and business. Why is that? Because it's not successful from the business perspective. I think 23andMe might be a good example. With a great intent, try to collect the consumer's genetic information, help them to manage their wellness, but they realize DNA sequence or information, once you know it, there's no continuous needs. It's a business model doesn't really work, so they really have failed to continuously engaging the consumer, so they ended up selling the data to the big pharma and generate the trust issue. And this dilemma, it's actually pretty common for a lot of these decentralized health data tech companies. Started with very good intent, but ended up, you know, have to go with B2B. Number two, don't only think about develop the country. Actually, because we interviewed enterprises all over the world, the two successful cases we found is in India and Africa. So I think one of the companies in Africa, I think most of their customers in Nigeria and Kenya, they already have like 400,000 users on their apps and continuously engaging. India, same thing. They tapped into the national health of, initiative and really got a great engagement with the customers. So I think the point I'm trying to make is just like the smartphone leapfrog some of the landline infrastructure in some of the regions of the world, don't only think about the developed country because they may have a lot of the baggage that it's harder sometimes to break the existing system than starting from scratch in some other places. So think global. Third, human issues always outweigh the technical issues. It's always a human thing. That's why I call data science decision science. Decision science, when it comes to the decision, it always involves human. So people need to understand your decision flow, the incentives with people, and read people's mind, understand the people before they really implement technology. And that actually gets to the second part of my talk, is why we have to think about technology and society at the same time. What's the relationship? I'm going to introduce you a new word if you have never heard about it. It's called AlgorVision. Anyone heard about this word? AlgorVision? Okay, nobody. Good, so it's a new thing. At least you pick up one new thing from my talk. So I got this from this book called The Secret Life of Data, authored by two interdisciplinary researchers from American University. And they deep dive into the datafied social order. Found it fascinating and terrifying. And AlgorVision refers to how we internalize our algorithm's perspective at the society level, often without even realizing it. So how many of you actually change your behavior for getting more likes for your posts on the social media? consciously or subconsciously, we're all doing a little bit, try to change our behavior according to an algorithm's perspective. So now you see where I'm heading to. Your algorithm, the variables you're putting into the device can actually shape what you're thinking. So there is this hypothesis in linguistics called Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. It suggests that the language we use not only describes the reality, it actually shapes how you experience. So for example, people who speak English, where blue and green are actually two distinct worlds, can visually distinguish these two colors much better than those who don't. So think about it. So that means the scheme you have actually shape how you experience life. So the more technology, the more successful your technology is, the more likely it changes the people and their experiences. And when I was in Takeda, we have this rule. When we have a tough decision, we have to think about, you know, assuming you are the patient, you're their caregiver, and within all the information in your hand, how are you going to make that decision? I remember this case where we have two manufacturer sites for a critical drug, and one had regulatory issue. The decision is asking, what are you going to do with the other one? Because if you stop the other one, it means no drug for patients, right? So it's a tough decision. But if you are patients or patient family, you'll find creative way how you do that. I think the same logic should apply here. If your technology is going to be very successful and people's going to live the lives according to the scheme you're setting, will you be happy with that? And do you think your kids, your grandkids will be happy with that? So next time when you put a binary categorical variables in your device or whatever, thinking whether you're contributing a more polarized world, black and white. So hopefully I kind of explained a little bit why we need to think about the societal perspective. But it's not just from the responsibility or ethical perspective. I think it's also make business sense to get a sustained business success. I think many of you have seen an app or a company launched with a very beautiful growth curve. But after a while, the curve started declining. Why? Because after people use it, they find all the problems, right? So we can't treat people as subject data sources. We really have to think from the human perspective. I heard the story, this lady who used the automatic insulin filling device, and she says, this device saved my life, but also ruined my life, because she suffered from this sleeping deprivation, constant wake up from the night, and also what we call alert fatigue during the nighttime. Technologies that saved our bodies but ruined our lives won't sustain. That means no sustainable business success. Because people live their lives, they not just survive. So you may say, Hui, I understand, but you know what? My company, I only have 1 year runway. Don't talk about the long term because I can't. But I have to say, balancing the rigor and speed, I think it's a constant things you have to consider from the business perspective. Speed definitely means a short-term success from the business or outcomes. But rigor, I think that brings your long-term sustainability. And it's going to be very important to think about the rigor. I'm going to give you some tips I learned throughout my career, some very practical tips. Number one, leverage regulatory framework. Of course, if you're in the work in the drug discovery or drug development or, you know, medical device that's need regulatory approval, you know you need to understand. But what I'm trying to say is, even if you are working with consumer products, understanding regulatory framework is going to be very helpful because it represents the highest bar of the rigorous, and understanding the disciplines and principle will help you to think about strategically what are the steps you need to think about early. So why regulatory, you know, wants a diversified data? Why they need clinical validation on top of the technical validation? Why they want the audit trails and traceable information? All these things are reasons. And I don't know whether you read this article published on New England Journal of Medicine AI, authored by Google DeepMind team director, and who also worked at FDA. And he's making this suggestion for the Gen AI regulatory framework. It should mimic how we regulating doctors, human, instead of software as medical device for the pre-gen. I think a lot of people, if you work in the medical device field, you know SAMD means, right? Software as medical device. But Gen AI, because Gen AI can think as almost like human thinking, so he suggests that we should train them like we train medical students, give them specific knowledge, like in the medical school, and give them board exam. And, you know, let them to continuously learn through the CME and give them the licensing and continuously monitor their performance. So this is, are you aware these trend of the regulatory thinking? Understanding regulatory framework is really going to help you to think about your strategy early. Number two, prioritize patient consent. I think the future is not just about data. It's about who's going to give you the consent to use, when, and how. I sometimes tell people, if you give me the right patient consent, I can simulate my competitor's data. So, and I can believe now with all the assistance from the AI, we can probably have some kind of the consent AI or a consent companion pretty soon. Instead of reading those hundreds of pages of consent, I can say, what does that mean? Like, tell me. You know, understand the terms in a much more user-friendly way. So I think consent is going to be very more nuanced in the future. And putting people's consent and put that strategy from your day one is going to be very important. Transparency. If you have to pivot your business from the B2B to B2C, make sure you tell your consumers. Don't let them find from the newspaper. I think that a lot of the things, that's what happens. So many companies, they have to, you know, do a happy or sad, you know, app for employee says, hey, help you, you know, mark your green day and red day. But then they figure out that doesn't work. They sell the data to the employer. You know, these kind of things really hurt you. So I think transparency is going to be very important. Trust takes years to build, seconds to lose. Develop multi-holder partnership. Multi-holder partnership, I think it really helped to de-risk your business. Thinking about partnering with nonprofit organizations like us, because we help to de-risk your business. We bring you broader perspective. We can connect you with the regulator, with the patient groups. We can help you really thinking the strategy. What can you do early and from strategic perspective? So at EHF, we're focusing on two areas. One is we call Healthcare Forum, where we want to link the different stakeholders in the ecosystem and find out the best solutions for our community. We have a young ambassador program. I see a lot of the young faces in the room. Young people, I think it's very important. We think we want to connect the future. Instead of pulling our hair, trying to get data from the existing system, we want to set up things right from the very beginning. when these kids, you know, turn into the 18s and become adult and thinking about their data, we want to set up things right. We also are borrowing the concept of the venture studio from the private sector. We're also setting up an impact studio, trying to nurture and fund informative innovation, innovative ideas, and hopefully can provide a sustainable engine for our organization. Moving forward, I think we are moving towards the future of the medicine 3.0. I don't know whether you heard about this word or not. Means the wellness management. So we're moving from medicine 1.0, disease treatment, to medicine 2.0, disease management, to medicine 3.0, wellness management. I think decentralized healthcare, putting the power in people in control of their own data, is going to be very important. In conclusion, hopefully, I convince you, bridging technology and society is critical for responsible healthcare data management. And it's not only just about ethical, it's a business, good business strategy. I know studies show that companies who really think about the societal perspective actually perform their peers by, you know, for ROI, like 4 to 5%. So it's a real number. And ignoring that perspective, it's not just the risk, it's really missing opportunities. So let's go far together, not fast and lost alone. And thank you. Here's our contact information. We probably don't have much questions, so but I will be sticking around you know, for if you have any question, if you want to connect with us. Very, very honored to introduce our keynote speaker, Dino. And from, okay, you're introduced.
Thank you so much.